just a group of people trying to decide what pizza to order and to agree on a thing like that. It can get so complicated. So I don't know how to do this. I just know that corruption and hidden agendas and secret societies are not the way to go. Total transparency, that is the way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, put it this way, we need to know, like here in Ireland, if the Irish people knew that they were paying their taxes to the British Crown, if the Irish people knew that they were being drugged, medicated in their water on a daily basis, I mean, that's growing now, people are realizing it. But still, if the main core of society realized the lies that they're being told and stood up and said no to this and yes to that, then we will realize what a true government is, administration really, and I suppose the word government, mind control, you wouldn't mind if the control was okay.
No, I mean, sometimes you need a leader who says, you know, like, okay, let's go for that pizza instead of these discussions going on and on. I mean, you look at the unions, you look at whatever groups and gatherings. I mean, the discussions can go on and on and on for absolutely no reason. So, but transparency, that's what I'm saying. Transparency, beyond lies, truthfulness, all these old beautiful things, you know, you know it, children know it when they grow up. Non-violence, truthfulness, non-greed, and honesty. You know, these are some of the basic things that it needs to be built on. And if it's built like that, then the future will just be stunning.
Absolutely. If we had governments that cared, if we had people as public servants who cared, if we had religious leaders who weren't liars as well, and they were willing to share spirituality, love and peace, rather than we're right, they're wrong, let's kill the ones that we don't agree with. You know, there's so much going on this planet that needs changing.
It's very simple. It's very simple. Truthfulness, transparency, non-greed, yeah. And for the people.
It really is that simple.
It's like so, and there's a lot of beautiful people around that could help with this as well, you know. So, but many of the people in government as well, you have to understand that it's so compartmentalized, and many people don't even understand that they're part of something very corrupt.
You know, that's right. Only... They think they're doing a good job. You know, that's a little bit like, you know, the man in uniform who joins up because he wants to be one of the boys, goes over to foreign lands and kills innocent men, women and children, thinking that he's doing right for his country. That's just beyond belief, really.
Yeah, but it's so tragic. I think especially when it comes to soldiers and so on, you know, they really like it. I'm on very many American shows, and when you hear that the soldiers, for one thing, they're so duped into thinking that they're going in, they're, you know, going to Iraq and Afghanistan, fighting for freedom. I would say, whose freedom?
Yeah.
You know, and why are they throwing rocks at you? Well, maybe you're not welcome. Maybe that's a sort of like an indication that something is wrong here. But they think that they're going to be treated as heroes when they come home. They think they're going to... that they're there to fight for freedom and democracy. It's absolutely not true. They're there as brutal enforcers. This goes for Swedish, English, Danish soldiers absolutely. As well. Brutal enforcers, killers, trained killers to carry out the agenda of an elite few that could not care less about these soldiers. They're empty uniforms. And if they don't fit into the pattern, they're just out. You know, you get another one. Yeah. And if you start saying anything against them, you will be charged with treason or as a deserter or so on.
Yeah, and also, you know, you're saying that they're going out there as killing machines and all the rest of it. They're also going out often as cannon fodder so that they get killed. So that then, a bit like a false flag, if you like, that the governments can go back in their country and say, see what they've done to our boys.
But not only that, it's even worse than that. You know, like in the Vietnam War, the companies that the airplane companies, what are they called? The airlines.
Okay.
Yeah. They, do you know how many millions of tickets were sold to soldiers paid by the taxpayers? Just a thing like that. Millions coming and going to Vietnam, both ways. And then the dead bodies, this is really gross, but a lot of these dead bodies were opened up, filled with drugs, and so that they were shipped home, getting tons and tons of drugs into the States by the same people that ordered them out into combat, because that was a major part, reason why they were there. It had to do with the Golden Triangle, but it was said, no, it's for freedom, it's against communism. Yeah, to some extent correct, but a major part was a totally different agenda that was going on. And these poor soldiers, they're being used, you know, for medical experiments, they're being exposed to radioactive ammunition and so on. I mean, just the mentality about behind using radioactive ammunition in a country that is 50% the population is under 15 years of age.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's just totally sick.
Yeah, well, this is it. The whole system and these elites are going to be proven and shown to be really, really sick.
There's a very, very... I mean, look at it. If you look at it just with a normal sense of logic, who could even come up with the idea of pumping up their fellow human beings with vaccines of which some of them are in the patent, are labeled weapons of mass destruction?
Yeah.
It's like, and they pump these small innocent children full with all this awful, awful crap that creates all these weird diseases and AD. I don't even know all these letter combinations that are, it comes from all these vaccines. Who wants to destroy the sea? Who wants to destroy the air with chemtrails? The seas with radioactivity, or they blow up these oil things outside in the Mexican Gulf. They try to pollute Mother Earth with chemtrails, not only the people, but also get the whole soil so acidic that the plants can't grow there, so that the GMOs are the ones that are resistant against aluminum, that they can be used to get total control there as well. What kind of mind creates things like this? Who could even in their wildest imagination come up with a thing like Agenda 21? You read it and it's like somebody's absolute mad, and then you have all these countries who have accepted it. It's crazy. I can't say it.
It's insanity. It's insanity, and it's
explode.
Ollie, it's insanity, and it's expanding into more and more insanity. So look, D. Greer has gone into his, from having to go with the words, he's gone into religious doctrine. So, that's that then. The judgment and the seal, the Lord of hosts and Jesus Christ will save us. Well, that's great. I hope he does. It's about bloody time, because there's a lot of shite going on and he seems to be ignoring it. There we go. That's
I would
my
like
piece.
To hear the, if he says this, the government does not mean mind control, I would very much like to hear what is the correct translation.
Well, government doesn't work that way anyway, his way. I'd have to go right up into the chat box to have a look.
It means mind control, so.
Well, we'll have a look and do a bit more research and maybe come back another time and be ready with that. But I tell you what, we could go into the vaccinations, we could go into all the different things that are happening on a global scale that is total insanity. But you know what? Let's get back to these celebrity bloody deaths, right? Because we... because yeah. I've already played Jimi Hendrix. Let's talk about him.
Okay, Jimmy.
Yeah.
At the time of his death, he was actually the first black rock musician that was really, really making it internationally. He came and was like an atomic bomb on the music scene in England and so on. And this was a really young guy. He was only 24. And, you know, not really I think, aware of the areas he got himself into, but he started supporting the Black Panthers and so on. And at that time, J. Edgar Hoover and the American government, they were really, there was a war going on. They would be part of the Martin Luther King assassination, Malcolm X and so on. And also, I cannot prove this, but I believe that they were involved in taking out Jimi Hendrix as well. The thing is that with Jimmy, he had a lot of problems with his manager, a man by the name of Mike Jeffrey. There was a lot of weird things around that, and Mike Jeffrey was stealing a lot of money from him and so on. So there was he was involved in the killing of Jimmy. But what I can say, though, is that the official story of how he died is an absolute lie.
Hmm.
It is said that he died from an overdose, but the actual way that he died was he was drowned in red wine. Somebody must have held him down and filled him up with red wine so that he couldn't breathe. Because
the mainstream media, Ollie, you know, if you go back to Jimi Hendrix's death, says that his girlfriend was with him and he took some of her Valium or tablets, barbiturates or whatever, and she went out shopping and came home and found him in his own vomit dead. Then there's another one that says she came, I've read a few of them, then she came home and found that he was choking and that the ambulance came and she waved him off in the ambulance with the people in the ambulance still working on him.
Yeah, but the thing is that, what you say, there are many different variations.
Mm.
And this is the thing with these conspiracy. The truth is very simple.
Okay.
What happened, happened. But when you try to, when there's a conspiracy behind it and people are trying to cover it up, you have all these lies, different variations of the truth. And one of the things with this girlfriend, there are many strange things about her. Her name was Monica Dannemann. She was a German a girlfriend who had known him for such a long time. And he died at night. But she said, because she died in a suicide afterwards, she said that she was with him. And she gave different variations of this story, multiple different variations. But if you interview the people in the ambulance, they say that when they arrived, they had no idea it was Jimi Hendrix. They just got a phone call that there's this black man dead in a room. So they went there. He was dead on arrival. He did not move or anything. And they took him without her and drove him to the hospital. When they got to the hospital, when they lifted the body out of the from the stretcher up onto the bed, there was red wine. As soon as they touched the body, there was red wine coming out of his mouth and his nose and so on. And his lungs were filled with red wine. But the alcohol level in his blood was very low. There was more or less zero, meaning that he could not have been drinking it himself. You know, it went so fast that he was dead before it even got out into the blood.
Hmm.
So he was actually drowned.
Okay, drowned in wine.
Drowned in wine, in red wine. And then also, which is more or less standard around these strange deaths, are that the people who are taking part of it as well, they have a very bad habit of dying violently as well. And the manager, Mike Jeffrey, he died 73 in a mid-air collision over France. And Monica Dannemann, they say that she committed suicide 2 days after a court case that had to do with Jimi Hendrix, and she was found dead in her garage in 1996. So there's very many strange question marks around that death.
Absolutely. So all the people who would have witnessed it or been part of it have had unnatural and weird deaths as well.
And that is more or less standard procedure when it comes to this. You know, they have to be shut up if they know too much or if they get close to many people, just like when she went to court, you know, in court, if people are being squeezed and pressed by the attorney and so on, they might, you know, slip or they might break under the pressure and start talking. So that is why many people that have been called to in front of commissions or interrogations or so on, just before they are called to give testimony, boom, they die, or they commit suicide by shooting themselves in the back of the head with a shotgun, or, you know, they're left-handed or they're right-handed but shot from the left, you know, the suicide is done with the left hand.
They're not even very good at these bloody killings, are they? They make so many mistakes that people like yourself and anyone who does a bit of research can actually look in and see all the flaws and all the truths that are shown by their incompetence.
But the thing is that we still don't wake up. So, I mean, I can't blame them. I can totally understand that they don't respect us at all, because I mean, to get away with these things, so obvious things, for such a long time, it doesn't gain us a lot of respect, you know, the way we should look at ourselves.
No, absolutely. You know, like, we actually just accepted what the mainstream have told us, and pretty much the same. I mean, I'm still meeting people here in Ireland that when I mentioned 9/11 was an inside job, they just laugh at me and honestly just repeat the bullshit from the mainstream.
And this is, you know, like, I get very tired sometimes.
Agreed, I do too.
Do you know, one of Hitler's, a propaganda minister, I think it was Goebbels, he said that the bigger the lie and the more it's repeated, the easier it is to make the man in the street believe it, you know?
Yeah, you're, because repeat a lie often enough and it becomes people's truth. And that is the way things seem to be going. Ollie, I've got a question from the chat room asking about, Jimi Hendrix's father. Did you know what he was and what ranking he had, etc.?
No, I do not know.
Okay. So Mahatma Coat, maybe you can enlighten us. You're usually full of great information and we'd love to hear what Jimi Hendrix's father was. Was he some form of military man or an elite? I think that's what you were hinting at. I'm not quite sure. But anyway,
I tell you, there's quite a few of these people that have parents, especially the fathers, in a high-ranking position. Jim Morrison was one of them.
Yeah, there were quite a few. But then, you know, you do think to yourself, well, you know, we know what we were like when we were teenagers. We know what we were like rebelling against our fathers. We usually went the opposite way, didn't we?
Exactly. So just because it's like that, it's just like my dad was a military man, but I mean, I go the peaceful non-violence way. So just like you say, it doesn't prove anything, but it's interesting though to see the facts and then see what you can make of it.
It really is. I mean, you know, if somebody has a, you know, is the victim of a child beater who is a father of yours, then, you know, do you just become a child beater, or are you actually, because of the beatings you get, willing to change that formula and go on to the next generation, making sure that you don't hit your children, for example?
I tell you, it's interesting now with this talk about generations, because this could lead us in a very beautiful way into the death of Bob Marley, if you want.
Okay, well, shall we play a track by Bob Marley before we do that, or shall we do one after?
No, let's go for it now.
Okay, go for it. But the tune or the explanation?
The tune.
Okay, we're going to take...
Can I make a suggestion if you got it?
Yeah, well, I've actually got them lined up, you know, the limitations of my poor broadcaster here, Ollie. I've got Buffalo Soldier on.
Okay.
Is that okay with you?
That is okay. Do you know what a Buffalo Soldier is?
tell me, Ollie.
It was in the cavalry, in the American cavalry in the... After the Civil War in the States, it was the Black American cavalryist was called Buffalo Soldier by the Indians.
Oh, there you go. So it was black man riding a white man's horse. What the hell are you doing coming at us?
Something like that.
So on that note, Ollie, we'll get into Bob Marley as soon as we get back after, of course, a track from Bob Marley.
Buffalo soldier, dread like a rasta. It was a buffalo soldier in the heart of America, stolen from Africa,
And welcome back to Out of the Bag. This is Sean Maguire live on People's Internet Radio. That's www.peoplesinternetradio.com, where we are seeking solutions. And that was Bob Marley and Buffalo Soldiers. And welcome back, Ollie Damigard, to Out of the Bag.
Thank you so much, Sean.
So, shall we get into the story behind Bob? Now, I've actually heard quite a few. When I was younger, I heard that he was something to do with the elections in Kingston in Jamaica, and someone shot him. Then I heard that another story about him getting cancer of the toe, and then that links in with various mainstream stories that I've heard continuing on from there. So, Ollie, fill me in on the truth.
No, both of the things you said are correct, but I'll just give it my version of the truth is the correct one. This is what all my years of research have led me to. So I can only present that, and then it's up to each and everyone to make their own research and see if it makes sense.
Sure.
I just want to remind people about Operation 40. And one of the key members in this group was a man by the name of Luis Posada Carriles, who was a former police officer from the Batista regime on Cuba, a very, very violent person and very, very active, way up to a very high age. I think he died a year or two ago, but incredible list of terror acts. I mean, he was part of blowing up a Cuban airliner. You know, he has just been part of so, so many assassinations, so-called terror acts, so you name it. You name it.
Okay.
Anyway, when it comes to Bob Marley, I think if people see him as a dope smoking guy who's just sitting around poking his nose, they make a major mistake.
Yeah.
Because this was a man that was a half breed. He had a white dad and a black mother. His dad was one of the like an owner of a plantation.
Okay, yeah.
On Jamaica. And he hardly ever met him and so on. But he grew up where nobody wanted to have anything to do with him. You know, he was a half-breed, or a mulatto. And the black people didn't, they looked down on him, and the white people looked down on him. So he had a very tough, childhood and so on.
a little bit like a guy being born in England of Irish parents, Ollie.
Something like that, maybe.
Just the skin colour didn't help poor old Bob, did it?
No, it did not. So, but at the same time, this was like a boot camp in standing up, you know, building some muscles.
Yes.
And he found his way through music. He found very early on that music was the way that he could be heard and seen and listened to, because everybody just neglected him. And through his songs and so on, and through this group, the Wailers, he became a major political force on Jamaica, to an extent that it actually came to a point where there was martial law on Jamaica, and the only one that could save the situation was Bob Marley. But before that happened, this was in 1976, but in 1975, the CIA and this global elite using the CIA through people like Henry Kissinger and so on, they tried to knock out country by country and country and globally. And in 75, the turn had come to Jamaica. And in 75, the U.S. Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, went to Jamaica. And he was, what also happened at the same time, he was threatening the people in power and also, but what they did was they started a whole, like a campaign of terror on the island. They pumped in weapons and they created different groups, terror groups, like paramilitary factions, but all of them had roots in Langley, and mostly they were financed by drugs and so on. The funds that helped build these terror groups were laundered by the league at the Miami Bank in Opt-in, which was a key American subsidiary of the Castlebank, then the CIA financial base in Latin America. This bank was owned and operated by a man called Paul Halliwell, who was the bagman for the Bay of Pigs invasion. Do you remember that we went back to before the JFK assassination? The same people are coming back again because they were working around Operation 40, laundering money, pumping in money, and so on. So we're back to the same team that are being used. And one of the people, because they also send in CIA-trained Cuban exiles to Jamaica to totally devastate the country, you know, with they started they burned down crops, they killed people, there was all this terror going on, and one of them were a man by the name of Luis Posada Carriles that I mentioned before, one of the major members in Operation 40. And in 1975, it came to a point, there were martial law on Jamaica, and it came to a point where Bob Marley agreed to be part of a concert to try and unite the island again, because there were two major factions on the island that was struggling, and two major parties and so on. And what happened was that just before this concert was going to be pulled off, a team of assassins entered Bob Marley's house and his studio, and there were 8 shots fired in through the back door of the kitchen. Bob Marley's wife, Ruth Marley, was hit in the back of the head. His manager was hit 5 times, I think. One of them lodged in the spine. Don Taylor was his name. And Bob Marley was... a bullet grazed his chest and hit his arm. But even though that happened, I mean, it was a miracle that he wasn't killed there. But even though this happened, Bob Marley insisted on doing the concert. You know? So he came with a bandaged arm and so on. He came very late, but he performed, even though people had kept warning him, saying, they're going to kill you, they're going to kill you if you get up on that stage. But he did it, and he really showed the elite that this was a major threat to them, because this was a man that would not back down. Mm-hmm. And anyway, he went through, he made the concert and everything, and he even got both the leaders for these two parties to come up on stage and shake hands, you know.
Yeah.
Which was incredible, absolutely incredible that he managed to do that. But then, the week after this concert, he was still surrounded by bodyguards because everybody was so alert, you know, they thought he's going to be taken out any day. And at that time, he was approached by a man called Carl Colby, who is a documentary filmer, mm-hmm. Who approached him and said, and asked if he would be willing to let this filmmaker make a documentary about him. And Bob was open to the idea. And then Carl Colby, as a sign of gratitude or whatever you want to call it, a gesture of politeness, handed him over a gift. And this was a pair of cowboy boots. Hmm. Now, Bob was really, he was extremely fit. And he was like always in jeans. He loved boots and so on. So that was the perfect gift for him. So he got really excited and pulled on one of the boots, and there was a witness there, a very famous photographer with I cannot remember his name now, okay. But he, when he described what happened was that he said that Bob suddenly just screamed and said, "Oh shit," and pulled off the boot, and there was a small little wound on his big toe, and inside the boot there was a piece of copper wire that had punctured his big toe.
Yes.
This is the same big toe that he later, that where the cancer started growing. I don't know if this is
thing. I've heard this story before, and it's basically that they gave him cancer of the foot. That's what they did by putting this piece of wire near his foot, yeah, and sending signals to it. That's what I was told. Now that really is getting into the realms of conspiracy.
But do you know who Carl Colby is?
Go on.
He's the son of William Colby, the former director of the CIA.
Uh-huh.
So, coincidence.
So quite possible.
I'm not saying that Carl Colby did this on purpose. I'm saying he could very well have been duped and just given these boots and not being aware of what he was doing. But I would say, suggest that this was not an accident, that this copper wire was done very deliberately. This, I just want to point out also that Carl Colby was later one of the witnesses in the O.J. Simpson case, being one of the neighbors of O.J. Simpson's wife that was murdered. So once again, one of these major, major big murder cases, and this guy is central in both of them. I'm just pointing it out.
Yes.
Anyway, but, or anyhow... It turned out after a while that that this cancer was developing in his big toe, and he was recommended to amputate the toe, but he was afraid. He was very much into playing football and dancing on stage and so on, and he absolutely refused to do that because he thought it will, if he loses his toe or his foot, he won't be able to do anything. So, and the cancer was a very strong cancer, but this was in 1976, and he didn't die until 81. And there's quite a lot of experts saying that one of the reasons why he lasted that long was because he was smoking so much marijuana and cannabis, and this is very anti-cancer. I don't know the English word for it, but very anti-cancerogen.
Okay.
Did that sound English?
It sounded good enough.
Yeah, because the oil from cannabis is very, very efficient against cancer and so on.
Yes, it's certainly a preventative medicine.
Exactly. And that is one of, they say, or this theory says that this is one of the reasons why he didn't die until 81. Uh-huh. But I think the year after, in 77, from that point on, he knew that he was dying, and he just decided to, I'm going to live a whole lifetime within the few years I have left. So he really went for it. And during that time, he became a major political power as well in Africa. He was, he started dating, I think it was the daughter of the dictator in Sierra Leone.
Yes.
And he also went to, when Rhodesia became a new free state, he paid for himself to get the whole equipment shipped from, I think it was the state at that time, to Zimbabwe. And he was doing a freedom concert down there. And he was just, I mean, the whole thing around him was just getting totally out of control from the global elite's point of view, because he was really becoming a major, major political power. And so they hit him again. They tried to get to him again. And one of the things was that he was approached by a doctor, a doctor with a what do you call it? A I'm sorry, my head is tired today. My English is not that good. But he was approached by a physician, a German physician, a doctor who had a history in the SS and the Abwehr in the Hitler, during the Hitler regime and so on. And this doctor took care of him in Switzerland, but according to Bob Marley's mother, in a very, very brutal way, you know, he was starved more or less to death, and he was given all these injections, but in a very, very cruel way, you know, Bob Marley's mother said that he was screaming in pain, you know, when he was given these injections. And yeah, they just cut off his Rastafari dreads and all of these things. It was a very ugly thing. And also, there must be a question mark why a former Nazi would put such an interest in taking care of a Rastafari. It doesn't really make sense, I would say.
It doesn't. No, and I did read about the Dr. Ilias, or?
Yeah, that's the one.
Yes, yeah. It doesn't make sense at all. And also the fact that, you know, Bob Marley's sort of family and friends were willing to go along with that and didn't intervene.
His name was Dr. Isels. No, but it's like, what do you do when you don't know yourself?
Sure,
you know,
sure.
These people were trying everything they could to, and they had no idea. They just were horrified when they saw the treatment and so on. Yeah. And he just slowly just decayed and disappeared. And then on May 11th, 1981, he died.
Okay, so it was a lie that I heard when I was younger about him being shot, yeah?
No, he was shot, but not to death.
Not to death. Ah, right, okay. So
Peter Tosh, one of his old partners in the Whalers, Peter Tosh was shot to death in 1987.
Right, yeah. And I'm a bit of a Peter Tosh fan myself. Brilliant stuff. Legalize it.
Yeah,
and all those
for
things,
sure,
yeah.
For sure. And there was a lot of very major question marks around that assassination as well.
Okay. So obviously, when you get a name, when you get, I suppose, a few million people around the world listening to your lyrics and maybe changing your lifestyle, acting upon them and understanding your own power because of either music, poetry, etc. Where does Whitney Houston fit into all this?
Whitney is a totally different story, I would say.